there was this great buccaneering age of war correspondence from, say, the late 19th century, when foreign news became something that really sold newspapers, and people went out and bought the newspapers to read about, in Britain especially, to read about far-off military adventures. And then, in a way, the military became aware of these war correspondents, and there was a real tightening in the late 19th century, last decade of the 19th century, and the first decade of the 20th century, a real tightening of censorship and rules, and not letting these war correspondents run around the battlefield as they were allowed to. And that reached its height, really, during the First World War, because the correspondents, the newspapers and the proprietors signed up to a very efficient censorship regime, and the correspondents who went to France went along with it. For the first few months of the First World War, they were allowed to roam at will around Belgium, around the front line, and then they were corralled and they were kept. There was a sort of elite corps of correspondents who were kept in a chateau miles from the front. They'd be driven down to the front, driven back, looked after all the time by a military escort, and then they would write up their reports, which themselves would then pass by the censor. And so that very rigid censorship came in during the First World War.
So just like the present day, really?
Very similar. I mean, in the sense of, especially if you look at something like the Gulf War in 1991, or even in Iraq now, there was a sense of being embedded. There was a sense of keeping them under control. But it was the sense in which, I think, which I talk about in the book, is how they willingly did it and willingly submitted themselves to it, which they had second thoughts about by the time the war broke out in Ireland.
Exactly, because you show that then by the time they arrive in Ireland for the War of Independence, in a way they're almost rebelling against that, that they want to stand up for the principles of British truth and justice, and therefore they're not going to go along with black and tan atrocities, and they're going to report it as they see the truth happening.
Well, there's a couple of things at work here, but one of them is that I ask myself the question, how did correspondents who willingly submitted themselves to the rigorous censorship of the First World War suddenly come over all adversarial when they arrived in Ireland to watch the black and tans? And one of the reasons is this was an opportunity for them to reassert themselves as truth tellers. And in a way, their reports were picked up by parliamentarians in the House of Commons who challenged the government. And then you see The Guardian and The Times and The Daily News asserting how wonderful a job they'd done telling the truth to the British people. And the background to all of this is an increasing, first of all, a debate about the efficiency of the censorship after First World War. In other words, the censorship was so efficient, the British propaganda was so good, that people reacted to it and said, well, what if this was turned against us during peacetime? And of course, there's a great reservoir of debate about liberal opinion and truth-telling in the British liberal tradition, which fed into this. And the correspondents you see then, if you look at their memoirs and look over a period, become quite ashamed of what had gone on. And Ireland was this opportunity to reassert themselves in their great mythical cast as great truth seekers and truth tellers.
Journalists like Hugh Martin, you show brilliantly, were prepared to challenge what was going on and challenge the actions of the Black and Tans.
Yes, they went to Ireland. Now, here's where Ireland, the reason Ireland was such an opportunity for them was, one, there was disunity at the top. And there's a very interesting book about the American war in Vietnam called The Uncensored War, quote unquote, in which Daniel Hallin shows how the American press, which is blamed on the right for losing the war, and on the left or on the liberal left in America, it's headed up as the press's finest moment. Hallin argues that actually the press followed elite opinion in Washington, and when the government began to split, then the press began to become more adversarial. And say there was a similar process at work in Ireland in 1920, because there was a split in both in London and in Dublin Castle. Some people didn't agree with this war. And it gave the journalists an opportunity to then become much more independent-minded than they had been allowed to be during the First World War, when, of course, there was this national unity consensus on fighting it. Ireland also was close to the heart of Britain. Irish nationalism was close to the heart of British liberal opinion. And so they went to Ireland and just ignored the government's efforts to try and get them to tell the story that they wanted to be told in Ireland. They went around Ireland. They talked to Sinn Féin and the IRA. They reported on atrocities and reprisals by the Black and Tans, and they really asserted themselves as independent correspondents.
And you also show that there was a number of American journalists, people like Carl Ackerman, who came over as well. Were they always going to be even more sympathetic to the Irish?
Well, no, it's interesting. Ackerman is a very interesting case. He's a great case because, as I discovered as I was researching this, journalists don't keep papers. Ackerman did. Ackerman was an American journalist who worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer, a very important liberal American newspaper at the time. He'd been reported in Germany, he'd reported in Mexico, and he'd been in the then Soviet Union as well. What is interesting about Ackerman is that the assumption you're saying there, we assume that American journalists coming to Ireland will be sympathetic to the Irish Revolution. Indeed, some of them were. And Ackerman's what I call a Wilsonian journalist. He has signed up to Wilson's principles. And if you look at how, again, in the 50s and 60s, it's well documented how American correspondents, foreign correspondents, became very close to American policy abroad. And in a way, Vietnam tore a hole in that and wrenched it, and that's why it was such an upheaval for journalism in the United States. And with Ackerman, you can see the beginning of that process. Ackerman believed in Wilsonianism, and he believed in Wilson's principles, and he believed in America's ability and growing possibility to change the world and influence the world. And so he looked at Ireland not as a romantic American, not as with green eyes. He looked at Ireland as a sort of piece on a chessboard of world geopolitics, and he wanted it sorted out because it was getting in the way of the sort of Wilsonian future. And so he got to know very well the head of the special branch in London. He became almost a go-between between the British government and Michael Collins, and he became, in what he wrote, he's interesting because he wrote this from this perspective, which was Ireland not as romantic cause, but as actually a way that Wilson could solve problems on the world stage.
And you also, something I'd never known, people like G.K. Chesterton, writers like that visited as well. You have a literary tourists, you call them in your chapter. So who were these people and why did they come?
Well, Chesterton originally came over actually to make recruiting speeches. This is right at the beginning of the period, so 1919. So he published a book just at the beginning when the revolution, in a sense, was getting into that phase that took off after the war ended at the Dáil. Chesterton saw in Ireland a country where, at odds with industrial Britain, and Chesterton has his own problems with industrial Britain, and in a way wrote about Ireland as a way where Chesterton exalted the peasantry, and in Ireland he found almost a challenge to the kind of industrial society that so he used Ireland as a critique. It's interesting. The other interesting one is V.S. Pritchett, who lived in Dublin and wrote for the Christian Science Monitor and was a correspondent here mainly during the Civil War. And Pritchett's observations are very cute and very interesting, and in a way that he was very young. He was about 23. It was his first assignment. And you can see the travel writer who later went to Spain, you can see him beginning that acute observation, and his accounts and his descriptions of Ireland and the politics of that period are very strong. And in fact, there's a backstory with Pritchett. He married an Anglo-Irish woman, and eventually they divorced, and Pritchett then destroyed all his papers from his period in Ireland. The third writer I look at is a man called Wilfred Ewart. And there's a story about how I came to find him out. I read a novel by the Spanish novelist Javier Marías, and which was half novel, half memoir, with real characters in it and fictitious characters. And I came across, he was writing about this guy called Wilfred Ewart, who'd, after the First World War, written a novel, which was a huge bestseller in Britain, a war novel, and was continued to be a bestseller into the 1920s, and then just disappeared into literary obscurity. And this interested Marías as a novelist. And he mentioned, as I was reading this novel, that Ewart had gone to visit Ireland and write about Ireland. Now, I wasn't sure at that stage whether Wilfred Ewart was somebody he'd made up or Wilfred Ewart was real. And then I found that he'd done a journey in Ireland and written a very interesting book. He wrote very well about the countryside, and he wrote very well about travelling around Ireland.
And did this all make a difference? Did this influence how the British thought the government thought they could continue with it? Did it make peace more likely?
I would say it did. You can see that if you look at the debates in the House of Commons, if you look at the cabinet papers at the time, they become increasingly nervous about it. And you can see people noting in diaries. I think Sturgis in Dublin Castle writes about this war is becoming horrible. You can see this revulsion. Also, what was interesting is looking at what was going on in Ireland in comparison to what was going on elsewhere at the time. Amritsar was happening at the same time, but Ireland was getting all the coverage. And in a way, Ireland was putting under the spotlight behaviour like that of the Black and Tans, which otherwise would have been hidden in far corners of the colony. So actually, all this reporting created a real knot of anxiety among the British elite, and actually they did want to have finished with Ireland because Britain had won the First World War on the basis that it represented civilization and the Germans barbarism, and this was becoming a real stain on their notion that the Empire represented civilization.
Okay, well, it's a great book and it gives a completely new angle on this period in Irish history. It's called The News from Ireland, Foreign Correspondence in the Irish Revolution. It's published in hardback by IB Taurus and costs £20 sterling. That's about 26 euro. And my thanks to its author, Maurice Walsh, for coming in tonight. Thank you, Maurice.
Thank you.
And we'll be coming up with more Talking History on News Talk after this.